like they found it. I mean, for all the time that we've spent here on issues, etc., moaning and complaining that evolution is a farce and that they've never found a transitional fossil from one species to another. You know, you can find evolution taking place within species. It's called adaptation. But we've often said here on the air they've never found one between one species and another. Apparently, at least according to the paper, they found it between a fish and whatever it is a fish is when it's walking on the ground and breathing air. We're going to be talking here in the first half hour with Frank Sherwin of the Institute for Creation Research about this alleged missing link between fish and land animal, whatever the land animal might be. They don't say what the land animal is. It's pretty clear that this is a fish. I don't know. I remember my aunt had a walking catfish. It was an albino walking catfish. You ever seen one of these? They'll scare the dickens out of you. She kept the aquarium in the kitchen, and this thing would get out of the aquarium. It was fish. You feed it fish food. Whatever you feed catfish. Get up out of the aquarium, walk on the counter. Yes, walk itself along the counter and often was found on the kitchen floor. I don't know. I mean, they called it a walking catfish. Maybe that's what they found here, just a larger version. I don't know. We'll find out here in the first half hour. Frank Sherwin will join us. You can join us as well. Our call-in number, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. We're coming to you live this Tuesday, the 11th of April. Now, coming up in a half hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, the field marshal, joins us. We've got three things we want him to respond to. First of all, this supposed lost gospel of Jesus. Elaine Pagels is all over the place talking about the authenticity of this thing. She would prefer anything to the four gospels. You could hand her a newspaper and she'd say this is more authentic than the four gospels. We'll get Dr. Montgomery's response. A scientific explanation for talking about someone walking. The fish walks out of the water. Jesus walks on the water. But there's a scientist saying, no, he was walking on ice. It's very simple. He was just walking on ice. Dr. Montgomery will give us his thoughts on that alternate explanation for the miracle that Jesus pulled off on the Sea of Galilee. And then there's a new book called The Jesus Dynasty. Pretty soon, this subject is going to play itself out. And you will not be able to write a new book about something that Jesus did that the Bible says nothing of. Pretty soon, they're going to stop with the speculation, but not yet. The new book, The Jesus Dynasty, some guy thinks he might have found the family tomb of the Jesus family. Now, this will be a good example. We'll be listening to some audio from NBC on this thing. CBS, ABC, I don't know. It's ABC. The reporter here at the end, he's got a Dateline special on this tomb that they found for the Jesus family. Sounds like it's going to be a balanced approach, actually. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery will be our guest for an hour from 3:30 to 4:30. At 4:30, chastity. You know, we could talk about the pro-life issue a lot, but one of the building blocks of a pro-life position is chastity. What is it? Dr. James Lamb joins us. You try saying it. And then from, 5 to 5:30, we're going to spend some time with Congressman John Shimkus. He'll join us here in Studio A, I believe, for a Washington update. And in the last half hour, there's been a Da Vinci verdict. Dan Brown was sued by the authors of The Holy Blood, The Holy Grail. We've been carrying for you throughout the weeks here updates on the trial in London. They've made a decision. We'll bring you the news. Also, John McCain, a favorite of some for the Republican nomination for president in 2008, was speaking at Liberty University. That, of course, is Jerry Falwell's territory. We'll find out what he had to say there. And Katie Holmes, along with her Scientologist husband, wants to have a silent birth. Have you heard about this? Silent. Shh. No, they're not married. They're not going to get married till after the baby's born. Shh. Silent birth. Katie Holmes, that's what she wants. We'll talk about it in the last half hour. Frank Sherwin joins us. He is a biologist, a speaker for the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California. And he is co-author of The Ocean Book. He'll join us here in just a moment. First, a piece from National Public Radio on this alleged link between the fish and the land animal.
Paleontologists working in a remote area of the Canadian Arctic have come across a relic of one of our most ambitious ancestors. It's a fish, but one that has taken an important step, literally and figuratively, toward living on land. It's big. It has a mouth packed with vicious teeth. And it didn't need to spend its life underwater. NPR's Richard Harris tells us more.
Evolution takes place every day in tiny increments. Ted Deschler at the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia has been fascinated by how those steps can add up, starting with a creature that swims in the sea and ending up with one that walks on land. That transition in the lineage that ultimately led to humans happened about 375 million years ago, long before the dinosaurs. To look for creatures during that critical time in evolution, Deschler and his colleagues dug into ancient rock formations in the extreme north of Canada, Ellesmere Island. They poked around for a few years without finding much, but in 2004 they finally came across fossils that caught their attention in a big way.
We have several individuals. The smallest and best preserved is probably about 4 feet long. We have the skull and fin of an animal that's significantly bigger. We would estimate at about 9 feet long. So these are pretty big fish.
And they were unusual in other ways, too.
The eyes were placed high on the head, almost like a crocodile. They still had scales covering the body. And they still had fins, which you would look at and say, well, that's a fin. It has the long rods that I'm used to seeing in a fish fin.
But this species also had some of the features you'd expect in the earliest four-legged land animals, the tetrapods. For one thing, its head wasn't simply an extension of the body, as you find in a fish. It could pivot from side to side. And the fins had bones that were starting to hint at a hand or a foot.
The fin was doing much more than a fish that's swimming through open water. In fact, it probably wasn't all that good at swimming through open water.
Instead, this animal was suited to crawling along on its belly through the shallow waters of a muddy river delta. And Deschler argues this is just the kind of habitat that created an opportunity for fish to emerge from the sea, not with one giant transformative step, but gradually, in fact, over millions of years.
You don't just swim and you don't just walk on land. There's plenty of ecological space for an animal that did some of each, or primarily lived in the water, perhaps on shallow water, using its fins to propel across the bottom or to scoot across a log or perhaps even a mud flat for short distances.
I mean, we don't really know, of course. We're looking at dead bones, and we can only say so much about likely lifestyles.
Per Ahlberg at Uppsala University in Sweden wasn't involved with this find, but he studies the ancient animals who evolved into land dwellers.
This seems a plausible kind of interpretation for the kind of life that this sort of animal might have led.
Ahlberg says the new fossil is quite similar to another ancient species found years ago in Europe. But that similarity actually makes it more interesting scientifically, because it shows that the fossils are no fluke, if you pardon the expression, but part of a sequence that ultimately led to the larger terrestrial animals.
And so, at a stroke, we now get a much more detailed picture of what our own ancestors looked like at the point when they were just starting to nose out of the water.
At the suggestion of Inuit elders who live in the Arctic, Ted Deschler and his colleagues named it Tiktaalik, which is a word for fish. Its description is published in Nature. And for all its significance in evolution, Deschler is careful not to call it the missing link between fish and our early terrestrial ancestors.
This is a link. It certainly was missing. But there are plenty more links to find in any evolutionary sequence.
And he's anxious to get back to the Arctic again this year to look for more animals on this evolutionary path. Richard Harris, NPR News.
All right, there's a piece from National Public Radio on the alleged missing link from fish to pteropod or land animal, this fossil found in the Arctic. Frank Sherwin joins us. He's a biologist, speaker for the Institute for Creation Research, based in Santee, California, and co-author of the book, The Ocean Book. Frank, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you, Todd.
All right. Did they find a missing link between the fish and the pteropod?
Well, I just have to agree with Deschler, who said it wasn't a missing link, and certainly the jury is still out. And we have to, as creation scientists, urge caution when all the champagne corks start popping and the evolutionists start celebrating. I think it's premature to say the least, and the jury is still out, scientific jury, as to what this creature was, even according to evolutionists. So we always like to say, let's wait a few years until the brouhaha dies down and then take a more dispassionate look at what this this creature might have been.
The way this is being approached, at least popularly in the press, is, look, it has the features of fish, and then it has some features that are usually associated with land-dwelling creatures. It is asserted, and I don't know how this assertion is made, that it would breathe both through gills and, I guess, with lungs, although I don't know that lungs survive the fossil record.
Well, you're right, Todd. When it comes to soft parts, such as organs like you say, gills, lungs, much interpretation is nothing more than educated guesswork. We have to keep in mind and go back to what evolutionists were telling us decades ago in regard to the fossil fish called coelacanth. Before a live coelacanth was discovered off the coast of South Africa, it was touted as an index fossil millions of years ago, and also a possible link between the sort of thing we're hearing now with this latest scientific news story. And yet, when they finally found live coelacanth, and they're finding live coelacanths today and have actually filmed them, we find that it's 100% fish. It has nothing to do with its so-called vertebrate land animal ancestry.
So if you were to classify what it is has been found here, based upon what we know in the press release and the various journals that have talked about it, what would you call this?
Well, Todd, I have to be careful because I'm still reading through the Nature magazine and some of the other Nature articles as well. But it certainly seems to be something very close to what we would call a lungfish, something that, to that effect. So we just have to be very careful about how we're going to actually classify this. I just have to agree again with Dr. Deschler, who says it wasn't a missing link and they're still investigating it. Let's keep in mind also, although it wasn't mentioned in that clip, the entire fossil has not been found, and so we have to keep in mind that only a portion of it doesn't have the tail or the back limbs.
The headlines, the tags on the pictures, fossil link between land and fish and land animals found in Canada, water to land evidence found. Why is it that when something like this crops up and is found, it is always portrayed in the press? Almost without exception, at least in the headlines. I mean, you could get down deeper in the story and find qualifications as evidence for evolution.
Exactly. Well, you have this great world view, the war of the world views between evolutionary naturalism and the non-evolutionary naturalism model of origins, which is the biblical model of creation. And I think, Todd, this is just a personal thing, with all of the intelligent design movement afoot and with this discovery very recently of soft dinosaur tissue, when you have the ID movement making such great strides, when you have a majority of school boards in more than half of the states of this country actively considering intelligent design, finding soft dinosaur tissue, there has to be some kind of big splash discovery that would somehow validate this bizarre theory called macroevolution, and how fortuitous that they have discovered this creature that allegedly makes a link between aquatic creatures and land creatures. It said, by the way, just very quickly, Todd, in the clip, it said it literally took a step. No, it didn't. We find that the pelvic girdle is not directly attached to the front limbs. The limbs are loosely embedded in the tissue, so this creature couldn't take a step if, indeed, it ever got on land. All it could do is kind of have locomotion much like a seal does.
Now, the case is made on the basis of common features. So they look at the bone structures, shoulders, hips, wrists, things like that in land-dwelling creatures. And then they find comparable structures in a fossil like this, and they conclude there must be a link between the two. How would you interpret the data there?
Well, basically, what you were just describing there, Todd, is something called homology. And in the Concise Oxford Dictionary of Zoology, they define homology as the fundamental similarity of a particular structure in different organisms, which is assumed to be due to descent from a common ancestor. And so, in other words, they assume evolution as they are, quote-unquote, proving evolution. And so when you see these structures that they claim are like a shoulder and wrist bones and all that, they aren't saying it's exactly like it. They say it's on its way to becoming like that. Well, there's a lot of philosophical interpretation when they start making statements such as that. I believe one article in the New York Times said the creature anticipated the emergence of land animals. Well, again, there's a lot of philosophical baggage with that word anticipate.
Okay, you mentioned before that the big term is macroevolution.
Correct.
How would someone who either holds to a view of intelligent design, or in my case, we're talking about someone who believes in a young Earth six-day creation.
Uh-huh.
How do we deal with the issue of within species? changes taking place over time are due to environment?
That's a great question, Todd. Basically, we're talking about very large change, which I like to call macroevolution. And when I have discussion with secular scientists, I always ask them to clarify what they mean when they say the word evolution, which is so vague as to be virtually meaningless. Do they mean large change, macroevolution? That's a vertical change, Todd. That's like fish to philosopher, particles to people type change. This discovery, this fossilized creature, is an example of macroevolution, supposedly. But again, we have to wait until the dust settles and before we can take a better look at it. Now, the kind of changes that we see in the laboratory, such as DDT-resistant insects or antibiotic-resistant bacteria, that's minor variation. That's minor change. And what I like to say as a creation scientist, as one who has been spoon-fed Darwinian evolution through my time in graduate school and undergraduate school, I maintain there are natural limits to biological change, and certainly we see that both in the laboratory and also very critically in the fossil record.
So to look at a creature like this, given the fact that it has gills, the simple answer is we're looking at a fish, perhaps an unusual fish, but a fish.
This is exactly what we would say based on, and I have to qualify it because I haven't seen the fossils firsthand. I've seen the Nature magazine article, read some of the evaluations there. We adapt this cautious wait-and-see attitude, remembering that the New York Times states it's still a fish, remembering also that Cambridge University evolutionist Jennifer Clack, who was not involved in the study, she said it's impossible to tell if Tetalic was a direct ancestor of land vertebrates. So we have to keep these statements by evolutionary naturalists and by a press that is friendly towards macroevolution in mind.
Now, another thing that strikes me about the claims made either by the scientists working with this or by the press as they report on it is that they seem obligated to say, this is our ancestor. This is what we were so many hundreds of millions of years ago. This is us. Why?
Yeah. Well, they presuppose macroevolution. And basically, macroevolution, this large change, this evolution from a common ancestor allegedly billions of years ago, is the only show in town, Todd. And so the press, which has a love affair with the secular evolutionary model of origins, which treats creation in a very negative manner, they would never even begin to print stories that would be very critical of Tetalic or some of these other alleged missing links. And so you always have this brass band approach whenever a missing link allegedly is discovered because, as I say, for them, for the secular media, macroevolution, our alleged ancestry from lower forms of life, is the only show in town, and they presuppose that. So when a discovery is made, like we're discussing right now, it simply validates this very bizarre scientific idea.
Now, viewing the fossil record, this is part of a fossil record found
Correct.
Up there in Canada. Viewing the fossil record as a whole, if we can even do that, does the fossil record, which includes bones and fossils of dead creatures, does it display what the evolutionists say it displays, this slow linear progression from one species, from lower species to higher species?
Right. It's interesting. I think it was a New York Times, April 6th of this year, interviewing an evolutionist who was asked that same question you just asked me, Todd, and he was only to give two examples of alleged transitional forms. One was called Archaeopteryx, this strange bird-like creatures by evolutionary standards that makes a link between dinosaurs or reptiles and birds. But creationists look at Archaeopteryx, which was discovered just a few years after Darwin's publication of his infamous Origin of Species. Archaeopteryx had wings, it had feathers, it flew, it had a robust wishbone. It was 100% bird, no problem. Then this evolutionist also mentioned a vague reference to a, quote, early whale that lived on land, end quote. But he never even gave the name of this bizarre creature. And so we would say that the fossil record is a supreme embarrassment to those who advocate that people came from lower life forms over millions of years. And for your listeners, Todd, I would suggest they get the book by Philip Johnson called Darwin on Trial. His chapter on the fossil record is simply worth the price of the entire book. The creation model is eminently supported by the fossil record.
Finally then, Frank, if someone mentions at work, hey, did you see that they found the missing link between the fish and land animals, how should we respond? 1 minute.
Okay, in 60 seconds, I would say that the jury is still out. If the Earth has been evolving for 4.6 billion years, we should find billions times billions of missing links. Isn't it interesting? This is maybe the third or the fourth very questionable missing link that has been discovered ever since Darwin.
ICR.org is the website address for the Institute for Creation Research, ICR.org. Frank Sherwin is a biologist, speaker for the Institute for Creation Research based in Santee, California, and co-author of The Ocean Book. Frank, thanks for being our guest.
Todd, I appreciate it.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to spend some time debunking some other common misperceptions and very popular and money-making misperceptions about the Lost Gospel of Judas and the Jesus dynasty. They say they think they found the family tomb of the Jesus family. And new scientific, actually it's not so new, but a scientific explanation of how Jesus managed to walk on water. Well, it was frozen. That's water, technically, isn't it? Frozen water. We call it ice, but it's still water. We'll talk about that in a few minutes with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Coming up this summer, Christ Academy 2006 will be held at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. I went there last summer to teach for a couple of days. A group of about 50 men, 35, anywhere between 40 and 50 men. And it was a tremendous experience to bring to them some real substantive teaching. We talked about Jesus and culture, the Jesus of culture. This is a rare opportunity for high school age men to do something like this on the campus of the seminary with the faculty of the seminary and in also taking part in the life, the daily life of the seminary, including the worship that takes place three times a day in Kramer Chapel. For more information about Christ Academy 2006, you want to send a young man who's high school age there for a couple of weeks to get a taste of what it's like to train for the pastoral ministry? Give them a call, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or find out more at our website, issuesetc.org. issuesetc.org. Now, if you don't know of a young man like this, go to your pastor and ask him if he knows of a young man. I was talking to the parents of one of my daughter's fellow confirmands. My daughter was confirmed this weekend. And it was a couple weeks ago. And I heard him make his give his essay during the church service, his confirmation essay. And I mentioned to his mother, he's not in high school yet, but he will be in a couple of years. You know, you might think about pointing him in the direction of the pastoral ministry. And she said, you know, that's not the first time we've heard this. Well, in 1 year, he's going to be a freshman. Your pastor knows of someone like that. Ask him if he knows of someone who should go to Christ Academy 2006. The number again, 1-800-481-2155, or our website, issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, the field marshal joins us, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. We're going to be talking first about this alleged lost gospel of Judas. Stay tuned.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a regular listener to Issues Etc., you know that every month we offer our Issues Etc. Book of the Month. Our book of the month for April, it's called Mommy Promises. It's a children's book about the unique relationship between mother and child. All of our Issues Etc. books of the month are available from Concordia Publishing House. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Or Concordia Publishing House also operates two bookstores in the St. Louis area. One is at 3558 South Jefferson in the city. The other on the campus of Concordia Seminary here in Clayton. Their toll-free number again, 1-800-325-3040. Concordia Publishing House carries our Issues Etc. Books of the Month. Our Book of the Month for April, Mommy Promises, 1-800-325-3040, or at 3558 South Jefferson in the city, or on the campus of Concordia Seminary.
From the National Institutes of Health, this is NIH Health Matters. Taking a look at your family tree could benefit your health down the road, according to the U.S. Surgeon General, Dr. Richard Carmona. Dr. Alan Guttmacher, Deputy Director of the National Human Genome Research Institute, talked about an updated web-based tool that can help families track their health history.
The nice thing about this is that it asks you specific questions about various relatives and helps you fill out a family tree about health history for yourself and helps organize the information at the end. It gives you a printout that you can take into your own doctor or nurse, whoever is your health care provider.
For more information about this initiative, visit hhs.gov/family history. For more info, visit www.nih.gov. From Bethesda, Maryland, I'm Bill Schmalfeld. This has been NIH Health Matters.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. More on the balance of work and rest. When you set aside time every day to be alone, time away from family, time away from church activities, time away from everything except yourself, then you will feel bad stuff rising in your soul. What worries you, angers you, makes you cry? That stuff will rise up in your thoughts and feelings. So much of life is garbage in, devotional time is garbage out. On the Monday of Holy Week, Jesus entered the temple area and began driving out those who were selling, reports Luke 19:45. Why? It wasn't that the church was dealing in money. What made Jesus furious was that this business was being done in the court of the Gentiles, pushing people away from God's worship. He quoted Isaiah 56, verse 7, "My house will be called a house of prayer for all people." Holy Week should be a holying time. A time, you know, like Peter, "Go away from me, Lord, I am a sinful man," Luke 5:8. But then from your Bible or devotional resource you hear, "Whoever comes to me I will never drive away," John 6:37. We all need this holying, this cleansing. Don't let the busyness of life push you away from the goodness and help of God. Let Jesus come in and cleanse the temple of your heart. I'm Dale Meyer.
Theology is the art of making distinctions. Theology is made up of two Greek words, theos, meaning God, and logos, meaning word. So theology is words of God, both about God and from God. And that's why theology is so important.
Law and Gospel with Tom Baker, weekday evenings at 6:05 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about a number of subjects with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. One of them, you heard about this, I read about in the paper over the weekend, the Lost Gospel of Judas. Now, they have a papyrus. It looks like a papyrus to me, a document that was found in, actually, at least if the pictures shown on the press are to be believed, in stunningly good shape for an ancient document, purported to be the Lost Gospel of Judas. We'll also be talking with Dr. Montgomery about a scientist's explanation. I think he's an oceanographer. He has an explanation for how Jesus managed to walk on water. The water was in its solid state at the time. It was cold and frozen, and Jesus merely floated on an ice floe out and past his disciples in the famous story from the Gospels. And then there's a new book called The Jesus Dynasty. An archaeologist, I think he's an archaeologist, claims to have found the family tomb, or he thinks it's the family tomb of Jesus. We'll put this all together and we'll get Dr. Montgomery's response to each and every one of these. We'll be playing some audio from the news sources so that you can get the full story and then Dr. Montgomery's response. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of England in Luton. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics in the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. He's authored and edited more than 50 books, including, I don't know, probably he's written one on this. Dr. Montgomery, what book of yours would cover the multitude of subjects that lay before us this afternoon?
Well, no one book would do that, but my edited collection, Evidence for Faith, would probably be the most helpful to people listening.
All right. Now, I've got to ask you a question. We often refer to you here on Issues, Etc., and then very kindly, with affection, off the air, as Field Marshal Montgomery. What do you think of the title, kind of the leader of the troops, the man out there on the front lines?
Well, actually, it is the same family.
Really?
Yes, Bernard Montgomery of Alamein was of one of the Montgomery families, part of the plantation of Ulster at the beginning of the 17th century. These were Scottish Protestants who were planted by the English king in Ireland in order to offset the Catholic population. And our family likewise were involved in that. And we know the son of Bernard Montgomery, so this is a very nice, close family connection.
What did you think of Montgomery, I mean, in the historical sense, as a general?
He was excellent. He's received criticism, but the fact of the matter is that he was a marvelous tactician, and for this reason was able to take care of Rommel six ways to Sunday in North Africa, and this was one of the most decisive campaigns of the Second World War.
That's good to hear. That's a good history behind all of that. Well, Dr. Montgomery...
Incidentally, I should mention that he was a very strong believing Christian and also a bit pietistic. He never smoked nor drank, and someone mentioned this to Churchill, and they said he neither smokes nor drinks, and he is almost always right. And Churchill said, well, I both smoke and drink, and I am always right.
Just the little edge that he needed over Montgomery, yes. I like the Churchill style. I'm actually reading an edited version of his memoir of the Second World War. It's fascinating, fascinating stuff. Well, here's the first piece. I want you to listen to it, Dr. Montgomery, and our listeners as well, and I want your reaction to what has been put forth in the press as the lost gospel of Judas.
Did Jesus ask Judas to betray him? And if so, why? For 2,000 years, Judas has been reviled for betraying Jesus. But now, we're learning that may not be true.
The New Testament portrays Judas as engaging in a nefarious act in turning Jesus over to the authorities. This gospel portrays the act as far from nefarious, but as, in fact, the greatest thing that Judas could do for Jesus.
At a news conference Thursday morning at National Geographic headquarters in Washington, a group of theologians and scholars discussed the impact of this new text.
The traditional gospels are ones that do claim to offer public teaching. One person, just a suggestion about the Sunday school teacher, said that if Jesus could say of his executioners, Father, forgive them, they know not what they do, would it be possible to speak of forgiveness for Judas, who's been the arch criminal throughout the history of Christianity?
The Gospel of Judas tells a far different tale from the four Gospels in the New Testament.
This looks like the writing of some follower of Jesus who was a dissident in a way and who thought most of the leaders are on the wrong track. So it sounds like a minority report.
In the text, Jesus is reported to have said to Judas, "You will be cursed by the other generations, and you will come to rule over them." The text, one of several ancient documents found in the Egyptian desert in 1970, was preserved and translated by a team of scholars. It was made public in an English translation by the National Geographic Society. Rita Foley, The Associated Press.
All right, Dr. Montgomery, that's the AP story about the lost gospel of Judas. Is this the first time that documents of these kind have been found and put up against the canonical gospels as what Elaine Pagels called a minority report?
Oh, not at all. The fact of the matter is that this is simply one of a fair number of so-called Gnostic gospels that were written late by this heretical sect called the Gnostics, and the purpose of these writings was to support their bizarre theology. And the theme of the Gospel of Judas, which, by the way, comes 100 years after Judas lived and died, and therefore there's no reason in the world to consider it as presenting anything historical. The theme of this is that Judas helped Jesus to get rid of his physical body. In other words, the idea was getting rid of the physical body so as to liberate Jesus' true spiritual self. There's a passage in this in which Jesus says to Judas, "You will exceed all of them, for you will sacrifice the man that clothes me." Now, that's the Gnostic teaching, that what we need to do is to separate the soul from the body, the spirit from the body. This is very much like Eastern mysticism. It's like various fundamental notions in Hinduism or Buddhism. But this is directly contrary to the New Testament. In the New Testament, the problem is not the body versus the spirit or soul. The problem is that the human race is sinful through and through, body, soul, and spirit, and what's needed is a Savior who will die, body, soul, and spirit, as a man to purge us of our sins.
Okay, so when someone hears about one of these Gospels, one is discovered or hits the press, they need to understand, it sounds like, that in the early and mid-second century, there was a very popular heresy in Christianity called Gnosticism that eschewed the material world, and that this and other so-called Gospels were put into circulation, were there as their version, their heretical version of the Christian message.
Sure, and they were almost always attributed to apostles, like the Gospel of Thomas, or here the Gospel according to Judas, or whatever. The idea was that this would give them some kind of authority. Of course, it doesn't do that at all, because they have no historical foundation. Incidentally, the London Times on the 7th of April had a third leader, in other words, a third editorial on this, which is ironic and terribly funny, and the title of it is Pieces of Silver, The Supposed Gospel of Judas Could Be Another Blockbuster. And the very end of the third leader goes as follows: "You know, this is going to be bigger than the Apocrypha, bigger than the Dead Sea Scrolls, bigger than Da Vinci. My God, think, the film rights. Where's Tom Hanks?"
Well, okay.
That really is just about what this thing is worth. And it's fascinating that they, of course, brought this thing out. National Geographic brings it out just before Easter, right? We suspect a certain economic motive. Incidentally, this was leaked in Europe before there was any word about it in the States, and I was at my favorite Parisian restaurant, La Serre, about a month ago, and while I was waiting for my table, there in the lounge, they had a copy of a French news magazine, and there was a spread on this. And I read this thing, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is going to ruin my appetite.
Did it?
No, of course not.
Oh, good.
We must never let the heretics interfere with haute cuisine.
All right. Now, Elaine Pagels is the kind of the go-to person nowadays when these things crop up. And she was shown in the piece, the video of the piece, carefully examining this, looking at microscopic pieces of parchment or papyrus. And then she concludes that this is credible. And this should be paid attention to. Your general response to Elaine Pagel's penchant for accepting as credible anything and everything but the four Gospels?
Well, you can look at the papyri, and of course this is exceedingly early. I mean, this is as we said, about 100 years after Judas lived and died. In other words, it's early second century. But my goodness, that doesn't make it primary source material in regard to the life of Judas or to the life of Jesus. You've got to have eyewitness testimony. You can't take stuff that is, what, four generations after the event and put that against material which actually represents eyewitness testimony. This stuff is what lawyers would call hearsay. And Elaine Pagels, you see, is of the view that you can slosh the biblical material and the second century material all together, and then you can simply make a choice according to what you'd like theologically. And that is logically bad. It's historically bad. It makes no distinction between the Gnostic stuff, which is second century, and the New Testament material that's first century.
People hear about this in the press, Dr. Montgomery, and they get the impression, and maybe it's fueled by all of the conspiracy mentality of things like the Da Vinci Code and others, that, wow, if we're just hearing about this now, someone must have been keeping it from me, and someone must have realized what a bombshell the Gospel of Judas would have been to the church and to its institutions, and so they kept it under wraps. Your response?
Well, and there's no evidence whatsoever that anyone has kept it under wraps. This Gospel of Judas was known, incidentally, to theologians of the 3rd century. For example, Irenaeus refers to this. So it was known, and it was consciously rejected by the church because it didn't represent any primary source material concerning Jesus. Naturally, right now, this is being presented as a kind of product of conspiracy theory. That notion, that motif, is exactly why the Da Vinci Code has sold like wildfire. See, today, where there is powerful governmental influence everywhere, increasing, creeping government and all this and that, people are desperate to separate themselves from the structures of modern life that seem so oppressive. And they want desperately to have some other explanations for things. That's the reason why conspiracy theories are so attractive today. If you accept a conspiracy theory, that means that you're rejecting the status quo, you're rejecting the mindset of the time. People want to run away from the mindset of the time, and so unfortunately they seek this kind of alternative.
We're getting Dr. John Warwick Montgomery's response to the Lost Gospel of Judas, and in just a moment here also a new alternate explanation for how Jesus managed to walk on water in that very famous and well-known Bible story. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Our call-in numbers, 1-800-730-2727. Or 505-7850, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Here's a report from Good Morning America, Dr. Montgomery. This one is on an alternate explanation for Jesus' trip across the surface of the Sea of Galilee.
And we turn now to a battle royal underway this morning over a story in the Bible. We all know the biblical story of Jesus walking on water. But now one scientist has stirred up a storm by posing his theory, which involves a cold snap 2,000 years ago. ABC's Jeffrey Kaufman has it all for us. Jeffrey, good morning.
And good morning to you, Diane. It's a theory from a Florida professor that is certain to evoke a whole range of reactions. Some fascinated, some offended, and some just left scratching their heads.
It is one of the most powerful stories in all of Christianity. As depicted in the book of Matthew, Jesus walked on the waters of the Sea of Galilee. Was it a miracle, or is there a simpler explanation? A professor of oceanography at Florida State University says he thinks he has the answer. It was a lot colder back then.
It's very, very likely that during those 100 or 200 years, there was ice thick enough to support human at least once or twice.
The professor says these containers hold the proof. On the right is plain water. It is not frozen. On the left, salty water, just like in the salt springs of the Sea of Galilee. It is frozen on top.
The ice that we were talking about only forms above the Salty Springs. It does not form over the entire lake.
But is all that science missing the point? To many Christians, the story is important not because of what happened, but what it means.
The story is clearly, in its context, meant to be a metaphor for trusting Jesus.
This same scientist created a stir more than a decade ago when he argued the Red Sea was parted not by God, but by high winds. Once again, his theorizing is not popular. His email box is overflowing with hate mail.
I think you are the most stupid person on the planet.
And that is one of the polite ones. The professor is unmoved.
I don't believe in miracles.
The professor is also not the first to try to offer a scientific theory. Religious historians tell us that 100 years ago, it was theorized that Jesus walked on a sandbar, not on water.
All right, Dr. Montgomery, that's a piece from Good Morning America. Your response, it seems as this piece seems to present only two choices. Either it's a metaphor, not a literal story of Jesus walking on water, but a metaphor for trusting Jesus, or there has to be a sandbar or an ice flow involved somehow. Are those the only two options here?
I just wish that I had an accent like Professor North of Florida State University. If I had an accent like that, people would listen to what I say.
Oh, I think people are listening already, Dr. Montgomery.
Oh, good. Oh, good. I'm so relieved. Yes. Yes. I'm sure my French is immensely better than his. Anyway, this metaphor thing. Listen. If you don't want to lose your mind, you must assume that people are speaking directly and they are telling you exactly what goes on, and they're not employing metaphors. I mean, if you read in the paper that there is a tremendous problem with Iran, and you say, ah, all of this is a metaphor. Iran represents evil, and the United States represents good. And all they're trying to say is that evil is trying to fight against good. You know, eventually the men in white coats will come and carry you off and put you in a rubber room, and this is exactly where you ought to be. As Luther said, in handling the Bible, you never assume that something is metaphorical unless you have reason within the text itself or in another clear passage of Scripture to attribute metaphor to it. Once you start this kind of thing, my goodness, suddenly everything is metaphorical. And, of course, if everything is metaphorical, nothing is metaphorical.
So the other explanation being offered here, either the one of 100 years ago that Jesus had found a convenient sandbar leading directly to the ship where his disciples were foundering in a storm, or that there was an ice flow and Jesus just floated to them. How do you assess
that? Well, this assumes that the people who recorded the material were imbeciles. They record this as a miracle, and there is Jesus walking on water, and Peter not thinking he can do this, and Jesus saying, trust me, and then Peter does it. I mean, what do you have, selective formation of ice? So that the ice appears at exactly the right point, and then it disappears so that Peter falls in the water when he doesn't any longer trust. I mean, the whole thing is just nonsense. And the commentator there said, should we consider this a miracle, or is there a simpler explanation? Actually, the simple explanation is the explanation given by the eyewitnesses, namely that this is a miracle. If you try to explain this thing by sandbars or ice flows or drops in temperature or something like that, you are forcing a complex and inadequate explanation on the facts. Incidentally, the professor says, according to one interview, we leave to others the question of whether or not our research explains the biblical account. Of course he has to leave it to others, because that doesn't offer any solid explanation at all. And it was very indicative that he said, I don't believe in miracles myself. We suspect, therefore, that his anti-miraculous worldview is the reason why he would come up with this kind of bizarre attempt to explain away the passage.
It seems to me that this one miracle stands as the one that has one for which one would have to the most far-fetched explanation. I remember in my seminary days, one of the higher critics supposing that Jesus fed the 5,000 because he happened to be standing at the mouth of a cave, and his disciples, in on the gag, were handing him a storage of food bread and fish, and that's how he pulled this off, and everyone was none the wiser. They all thought he performed a miracle. He just had stored up a bunch of food. These explanations turned Jesus into a charlatan.
Well, sure, and when I was very small and on one of those awful liberal ecumenical churches, before I became a Christian, even then I recognized the nonsense of this kind of thing. I had a Sunday school teacher, a sort of Lady Bountiful type, and she said, children, you know what happened with the feeding of the 5,000? Actually, everybody did have food with them, but they were selfish. And then when the little boy took out his food, they felt guilty, and then they took out their food, and that's why there was so much left over. And at that point, even then, as a, I think, 7 or 8 year old, I said, now would you explain the resurrection? And she was furious. Boy, she was mad.
Well, that kind of brings us to the point here as we're going into this break, Dr. Montgomery. If someone could, I guess in theory, come up with plausible explanations for every single miracle, but the resurrections, that's a toughie.
Yes, it certainly is. And if Jesus conquered death, then isn't it more reasonable anyway to assume that these miracle accounts during his ministry are veridical? I mean, isn't he the kind of person who would have done this sort of thing? And this follows through to the virgin birth. Wouldn't you expect something special in a case like this?
Now, one of the things that was raised in the piece that we heard regarding the alternate explanation for Jesus walking on the water, near the end of that piece, if you heard it, Dr. Montgomery, was one of the scientists talking about the kind of hate mail that he's receiving from people. I'm wondering if someone so adamantly disagrees with these alternate explanations, is this the, for those of us who do believe Jesus walked on water, is this the way to go about it? Send off a nasty missive to him and tell him how stupid he is.
It's very sad, and it's counterproductive. In the case of the book that we were talking about, well, the book we will be talking about, the Jesus Dynasty, you know?
Yes.
On the Amazon website, there is a description of that book that goes like this. He denies the truths of history and starts from a position that the Bible is wrong. From there, you can spin off in any number of incorrect directions. The book will appeal to those who refuse to believe the truth of God's word anyway. Yes, it's well written, but so is what Satan did. Sadly, there will be those who are seeking to know God and his son Jesus Christ will pick up this book and be led astray. Bottom line, if you're lacking in discernment and reasoning, you'll probably like this and probably like Dan Brown's horrible book as well. You know, that kind of thing appears on the web from evangelical believers all the time. And when unreasoned criticism like that and, four-letter comments about the non-Christian are presented, all that does is to make the uncommitted person wonder if maybe there is something the matter with Christianity.
Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. When we come back, we're going to talk about that new book, The Jesus Dynasty. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He is Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana. And he's authored and edited more than 50 books, including Evidence for Faith. You can call us during this break. It's a great time to call 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.